Welcome to Hoop du Jour with moi, Peter Vesey, presented by the National Basketball Retired Players Association.
Well, Peter and I are back for week two after the rousing reception and the fact that we were not canceled after week one. But as much as it galls me, and it does gall me on several levels, to pay you a compliment. If you judge someone by the company they keep, once again, you went to the well and you found yourself grade A material.
It's Julius Erving the first week and now Oscar Robertson the second week and it's going to keep getting better and better if that's possible. I can't say it enough. I know people say, you know, I'm a hardcore guy and how could I actually be in awe of players that I covered, but I do, and that's why I'm doing these podcasts, and that's why I'm doing the blog about the retired players. I do so respect them, and I'm so privileged to be able to talk to them.
One of the leads that you had written, it doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess theoretically it was when you talked to Wilt, and Wilt had said from out of the blue, said to you, "Don't ever let him forget how good we were."
He said great.
How great we were.
Yeah, he said great. Yeah, we were receiving an award up at up in Harlem, and I was shocked that he showed up, actually. And there he was and having a great time. And we were watching old All-Star guys play, like Dean Memminger and Tiny Archibald and Earl Manigault. And, yeah, and out of the blue, he just said to me, he says, you're one of the few guys that's seen – you know, everybody play back in the day, and now you're still writing. And that's when he said, "Don't ever let them forget how great we were." And I was astounded that he said it, and so honored that he said that to me. Yeah. And I've kept it up. And then 13 months later, he died, and that was the last time I spoke to him. So, very very meaningful stuff, Frank.
And again, before we get into Oscar, there is no better example of don't ever forget how great someone was, because this man at every level, high school, college, pro, if there was anybody better, you'd be hard pressed to find him.
Yeah, I mean, people will say Michael Jordan, of course, and they probably are right there. But what bothers me, Frank, is that when I was first covering, you know, the best guards were West and Oscar, you know, the centers were Wilt and Russell, and the best forward was, you know, Elgin and then Rick Barry and Hunt and Havlicek. But now today you look back and they don't even make the top 10. Some of them don't. Some of them do. Some of them don't. But, Oscar and West were replaced by Jordan and Magic. Fair enough. But then they're on the second team. Don't tell me they're on a third team.
No.
Okay.
The league has not been around that long, and we're now in year 75. Right. That they've been kind of pushed to the kiddie table. They're still at the adult table.
Right. Right.
And you'll hear from Oscar. And again, for those who are not familiar, just take a look at the resume.
Let's bring him in. Let's bring in Oscar. Oscar, my friend, you know, it seems like it's 50 years since I've been interviewing you, but actually it's longer than that.
Wow.
we go back to the early 70s, but I'm going to take you back, first of all, to the first time that I saw you play. I was a freshman in high school, and I got a ticket to a game at the Garden, and I went to see Cincinnati play Seton Hall. And I had not heard of you. I apologize.
It's all right.
And you lit up Seton Hall for 56 points. Actually, outscored the whole team 56-54. And that was my first impression of you. What was your first impression of playing in Madison Square Garden?
Well, naturally, playing a basketball player, you heard so much about Madison Square Garden and all the great legacy that it had, and even all of the great writers, Lapchick and Fuzzy Levine, and all the player coaches and players who were there. And a friend of mine from my high school named Willie Gardner got a small, short time with the Knicks. So that's how I heard about Madison Square Garden. And I must tell you, to be honest, when I walked from my hotel, the Manhattan Hotel, up to 49th Street, and I was with my roommate, I said, "Is this the garden?"
A little dilapidated, wasn't it?
It's like a big hay barn. And you know, then you go inside, Peter, and the baskets had long guide wires holding them up from the top of the arena.
Right.
And sometimes when you got ready to shoot a free throw, someone would get on the guide wire and shake it.
Oh, shake it. Yeah. One of the betters there.
Probably so.
You know, Oscar, Willie Gardner, if I recall, had a heart problem, right?
He did. He had a heart problem, so he couldn't play with the Knicks at all. Great athlete in high school and played with the Globetrotters for quite a few years. And then they sold him to the Knicks, and that's when it ended for him.
I'm gonna bring in my column castigator, Frank Drucker. He wants to start you off with a question regarding the Bucks, okay?
Go right ahead.
And Oscar, first of all, it's a pleasure, but more so this season because we're now at 50 years since the Bucks won their first, and we're still sitting at one NBA title. And I guess looking back on that season, you guys went, 66-16? I did a little research. You reeled off a 20-game win streak, a 16-game win streak, and a 10-game win streak. Then you win 12 or 14 in the playoffs, and it seemed at that point that you guys were a dynasty in the making, but the title number sits at one.
Yes.
Why weren't there more?
Because we didn't win.
Yeah. Okay.
But you had the talent.
Well, we did and we didn't. You know, I'll tell you why. I thought about this many, many times, even when this incident happened, which I will tell you about. After we won the championship, they traded a starter in Greg Smith. They traded Bob Boozer back up forward, Dick Cunningham back up forward, and McCoy McLemore back up forward. They traded all those guys from our championship team who were so instrumental in us winning away from us. They brought in all new guys. And at that point, I told someone that was a friend of mine that we can't win anymore.
But you came really close at 74. Right down to the seven games. I mean, look, Frank and I have studied game six at Boston Garden. And so we have many, many memories from that, including highlighted by Kareem's hook to win it. Tell me what you remember about game six and then that seven game series.
It was a very tenuous game. Two great basketball teams going back and forth and some good athletes. But the one thing that Milwaukee missed was Lucius Allen. I don't know if you know it or not, but Lucius Allen had gotten hurt at the end of the season, and he couldn't play in the playoffs at all.
He slipped on a towel, didn't he?
Something like that. And I think his lack of speed in our game at the other four, the guard spot, really hurt us because they were double-teaming me all night. And you know, and so I'm trying to get the ball to other people and whatnot. But if we had him, it might have been better, but you never know. You know, they beat us, and that's the way it goes. You know, what else don't matter anymore.
Yeah. Well, Havlicek had four unbelievable shots in the overtime, second overtime. You had a couple field goals. Who was it? Davis had an unbelievable – Mickey Davis had an unbelievable field goal. But then Kareem wins it. I mean, that shot – is not talked about enough today, or they don't talk about the old days at all today. But
they won't talk about that shot because it happened in Boston. but really, that was his signature shot, sky hook. And you look at the way he was so dominant with the sky hook in those days. Why none of these other players who come along now could even get come close to shooting that shot?
Why do you think? Why do you think it's such an unstoppable shot?
I think the way the college game has evolved, and that it's a zone. Coaches want to eliminate any kind of possibility of making mistakes. They either shoot an outside shot, 3-point shot, or you go inside. inside to a to make a dunk. But Kareem being 7 foot two had a distinct advantage against a lot of players, but not all, because some guys were just as tall as he was and real good defensive players, but he had an advantage over some of the players.
Oscar, when you joined him in when you were traded, first of all, why were you traded? Why did Cincinnati give you up? Was there a problem between you and Cousy? Or was just Embry wanted you so bad, ex-teammate?
What did Wayne tell you?
I haven't spoken to Wayne in a few years. I have to go back a ways.
Yeah, you're asking about it. He'll tell you what happened.
Well, we'll get him on again. But you mean why he got you or how he got you?
Well, now you know, at Cincinnati, you know, they decided that I wasn't any good anymore. They had this effort to discredit my basketball ability, and it got to a point where it was just like a smear campaign against Oscar Robertson, and all I did, Peter, I just made all pro 10 straight years, you know, top five, but because they wanted to move the team to Kansas City from Cincinnati, they thought they could have more hot dog sales in the 19,000 seat arena than they had in Cincinnati. Right. And they got Bob Cousy to trade all the players away.
Yeah, I mean, I knew there was some friction there. I didn't realize that they had a smear campaign going against you. Embry was your teammate, and then he was able. So he was the first black general manager in the NBA, and he was able to get you pretty cheap.
Well, yeah, I guess I was in terms of the way basketball is paying out salaries today. I was pretty cheap.
Well, I mean, as far as what they gave up for you, I mean, like you said, all pro 10 years, and now they're able to get you. Pretty amazing.
This is what I mean, Peter. They didn't care about anyone else coming back to the world. They just wanted me out.
Really?
And obviously, they didn't read my contract because I had final say over trades and whatnot, and they were really upset when they found that out.
What did that cost them?
It didn't cost them anything. It just like egg on their face because they should have known this. And yeah. instead of going to the press and say that, oh, I haven't done anything, and I didn't like Cincinnati and all these things like this, they should have taken that into consideration and say, listen, and come to me as a man and say, hey, look, Oscar, you know, we feel it'd be best for Cincinnati and best for you that we move you to another team. And I would have said, okay, let's talk about this and get this resolved then.
You know, Oscar, I've done a lot of research. As much as I know you over the years, I found out things I never knew before. One of them is that in 1967, when the ABA began, the ABA was really in pursuit of you, and to the point where a writer from Indianapolis and your high school coach would go to your house and recruit you. How close did that come?
That didn't happen. I got a call from the guy who was a president of the Pacers, and I knew him very well. And he asked me, he wanted me to come over and play for the Pacers, but you know he didn't want to pay me any money. he thought I would do it just because I was from Indianapolis. But right. You know, it was difficult times then. You know, they got a fair amount of good players on the ABA teams, and after a while they saw they couldn't make it alone, so this is why they tried to merge together. But yeah, I talked to Storen, was his name, I believe.
Mike Storen, yeah.
Mike Storen. He's the one that called me and talked to me about it, but no one else really tried to recruit me to go over there. Just okay. some of the guys I knew in the city that I played against wanted me to come back, but that was about the extent of it.
But then Cincinnati gave you $100,000, from what I read. They gave you a new contract, and that was the end of that. But Oscar, Storen, you recommended Roger Brown to Mike Storen. How in the world did you ever know about Roger Brown? He wasn't playing pro ball. He was playing in Dayton, AAU ball. How did you know about him?
Well, actually, one night in the Garden, I saw this All-Star game, Roger Brown, Connie Hawkins, Bill Shimanowski, George Wilson, and a couple other ball players. And that's where I first saw Roger Brown play. Then he had a short term at the University of Dayton. been big for a while. We used to play pickup games in the summer. The guys from Cincinnati would go to Dayton. Dayton would come down to Cincinnati. We went back and forth. So that's how I got to know Roger. And then when Mike Storm was trying to sign me, I said, listen, I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I got a guy that you ought to go and take a look at. He'd be great for your team. And that's how I got there.
Said it was the best advice he ever got, and it was free advice.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, it is free. I mean, I just thought he'd do the best for the Pacers since they needed a forward of Roger Brown's caliber, and he really played well for them. You know, he did a great job.
I mean, how good do you think Roger would have been had he not been blackballed for 6-7 seasons? I mean, to me, he was one of the greatest forwards I've ever seen play.
Very good, about 6'5½". You know, outside player could dribble, make the pass, shoot the shot, go to the basket, jump like crazy. You know, he was just an all-around basketball player. Reminded you a little bit of Elgin Baylor, but he wasn't as strong. Elgin had a lot more strength than he did.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was different kind of player. But Roger could set you up and go around you, shoot the jump shot. He just had a real good knack. Had a good knack of the game. He had an experienced knack of the game from his head position.
Right. You know, I've talked to Jerry West about how he had a difficult time breaking into the NBA, and he's always gushing about how you had no problem in transition from college to pro. So I looked up your first game as a pro. Do you have any idea what you did your first game against the Lakers?
No, I don't know what happened at the game.
It was a triple double.
Oh,
your first game, Oscar.
And they didn't even tell me.
Well, we know there was no such thing. It was no such term in those days, but. How, you know, it's amazing over the years how that's become such a signature for, you know, for Westbrook, et cetera. But he still hasn't caught you.
Well, I think he will. And I've been glad when he does because I think he's a tremendous basketball player, an athlete. And I tell you, and I think it's really something that sports writers are sort of getting known and saying he didn't do this. He didn't win a championship. And the kids, all they know is playing MVP basketball every night.
Oscar, why was it so easy for you to make a transition while Jerry West, who was comparable to you in college, had a difficult time? Half a season it took him.
It wasn't easy, I tell you. You know, I've thought about this quite a bit over the years. I've talked to a few of my fans, and I really respect their basketball knowledge about. When I came to Cincinnati, I got into a situation with the Cincinnati Royals. When I got down there, Peter, the competition – during practice was not great. They had players on the team. Were not very good pro basketball players. And coming from Indiana, my competition I had there, and especially outdoors, playing against older guys and all the high school games, pressure games I played in at the Butler Fieldhouse up there, sellout games and playing in two state finals, it sort of gears you, gets you ready for those types of things. So I wasn't nervous or anything, but what I realized is that they wanted me, fresh out of college, to carry this team, to win for this team, and to be honest, I mean, when I got a lot, I thought that was just really unfair.
Right.
Because I'm glad I was able to do it because I evolved into the situation, but can you imagine that to ask a rookie? Although I played well in college, I think many of us prepared for it, but the law should have made some other adjustments in order for me to have more help. Maybe we could have done better apparently.
Well, I mean, Little Lady had Jerry Lucas. You had a heck of a team for a while. A lot of good players. What do you think would have happened if you stuck there long enough to play with Maurice Stokes?
I've always said this, and I'll tell you again for people to understand how I felt about Maurice Stokes. He was a tremendous, tremendous basketball player. I don't think if you look at Zion Williamson today, other than the dunks, you look at Maurice Stokes, how he could dribble the ball and go around people. Now Zion has much more jumping ability than Maurice Stokes did. But Maurice Stokes, his first year in basketball, averaged 17 points and 17 rebounds. went to St. Francis College, and he is a person who played in the Holiday Festival one year. They wound up in fifth place, but he was the MVP of the festival. That's what people thought about him.
Right. I did not know that. I don't think I saw him play in that festival, but I saw you play in, I believe, the festival against Tom Spith.
Yes, we did. We played St. Bonaventure, played Iowa, St. Joseph, and one other team. I think they went four basketball games to win that championship. But it was a good tournament. Those tournaments were great in those days because New York was the center of all of basketball and all the greats of the. And the fans, Peter, the fans were there. They enjoyed basketball.
Right.
Not like a lot of places I played in the NBA. When no matter what you did, they boo you.
You know, it's funny how things stick out in your mind. I bring up Tom Stith. Probably nobody in the audience ever heard of him, but he was an unbelievable player. St. Francis Prep in Brooklyn, and then St. Bonaventure, as you said, and then he got sick, and then he got in a car accident. But I saw him outplay you for a half in that tournament, and I believe you got 40 or something in the second half. Do you remember that game?
No, I think he beat him.
Yeah.
You know, and as a matter of fact, you know, he didn't even make the Olympic team.
Yeah, well, I mean,
in 1960.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought he should have made it, but I'm just one person. I didn't have a voice in it whatsoever in picking the team.
Well, let's go, that's a good transition. Let's go to that Olympic team, 1960. You know, everybody talks about the 92 team being the dream team. I've always said that your team was the original dream team, only it was amateur. Again, you, Jerry West, Bellamy, Lucas, Boozer, Adrian Smith, who am I missing?
Terry Dischinger
from Terre Haute, right?
Al Kelly and Bertie Halverson.
I looked up Burnett today. I looked him up today. I didn't know who he was. can you just tell people about him a little bit? He's one of 11 guys that played on two U.S. Olympic teams.
Yes.
And I never heard of him until I looked him up.
Well, Bernie was a good college player from Colorado, and he was with the AAU team that we competed against at the Classic out in Denver, and he made the team along with Boozer, Al Kelly and Les Lane. Good player, good post player. But he didn't have the play for Walt Bellamy. I must tell you, Walt Bellamy was outstanding. And I must tell you, Walt Bellamy, a player that we got on the Olympic team through Pete Newell's efforts, because the AAU, which was very, very strong in those days, didn't want to take Walt Bellamy on the team.
Well, I recall that Walt stayed an extra year at Indiana so he could maintain his amateur status so he could play in the Olympics, correct?
No, that was Bob Boozer. Boozer stayed.
No. Bellamy did that. He definitely did it.
Yeah, Bellamy was with sophomore when I was a senior.
Right.
So he was behind me. Bellamy came up. He was a sophomore when he got on the team to try for the Olympics. I was a senior.
All right, I'll slouch corrected for the moment.
Yeah,
Oscar, what about that team versus the 92 team? I mean, you can't call the 92 team the old dream team when you guys what you had.
Well, see what happens over the years, Peter. You get the press involved in the situation, and it's all blown out of proportion. It's like apples and oranges, you know. We had a very good basketball team. I think margin of victory was 34 points. And the guy said, because they had Michael Jordan, Magic, Larry Bird, you know, do I think they could have played them better than us? No, they didn't.
Yeah.
So they went undefeated, so they did.
Oscar, how do you think you would play in today's game?
At 82, not very good.
Why?
At 82 years old?
No, you could still do it, Oscar. Come on.
No, you
could still. No, wait. You could back people even better now. They can't put their hands on you.
Well, you know, I was weaned on playing one-on-one basketball, Peter, out in the parks in my early days and when I was in high school. I think that anyone today who can dribble with the basketball and have some abilities and can shoot fairly well can play professional basketball. But see, if you look at the good player, they talk about Curry's shooting. Curry is a heady, very smart basketball player. If you look at him play, he knows the game. He knows where people are, and they just cannot contain him. They can't contain his 3-point shot, and he can go to the basket almost anytime he will. He knows the right cut when people are away from him. So that's the type of thing that a player has to have: be able to dribble a ball, put it on the floor, and shoot a shot.
So you're saying all those guys back in your time, the superstars, they'd have no problem playing today.
Well, let's name some from the Knicks, since you're in the Knicks. Willis Reed, Bill Bradley, DeBuscher, Earl Monroe, Walt Frazier.
Yeah.
You think they could have played in this day and age?
Yes, I do.
Well, that's what I mean. Even though I think now that the players are more athletic and the way they jump and whatnot, but years ago, the centers didn't leave in front of the basket. If their man could have gone downstairs and taken a shower, they were still going to protect the basket. Now, they got this thing that they're going to change the rules and mess up this thing so bad that if the center goes out to the top of the circle, you have to follow him as a defensive center. And he's not going to make any shots out there. If he starts to make the shots, you go out and get him.
Right.
But the rules of things have changed every so often to enable certain players. And you know that as well as I do.
Does it bother you, Oscar, as it does me, that, Elgin Baylor dies and people suddenly discover how great he was, or they're finally talking about how great he was? I mean, there are just so many players, including yourself, that just don't get the recognition that baseball players, old baseball players, do today. Like when I was growing up, we knew who Ty Cobb was and Tris Speaker and Nat Lajoie and all that stuff. But they talk about Elgin Baylor. I mean, I watch shows, people go, man, this guy was really good. Really?
You know what happens, Peter? Guys like you who understood basketball, you moved on. You got in there, and all of a sudden, here comes some of these young kids out of college, probably straight A's, and they read a sports page, and they think they know everything about basketball. And here again, I think with the Elgin situation, if I can recall it, he wasn't doing that well with the management, with the Clippers. And I think that hurt him. I think that hurt him immensely. Because as great as he was, he got no press from players. And you see guys say, man, I'll say this, and then I'll move on. They get on TV and talk like, fuck, when a guy dunks a ball, they want to jump out of their skin. Even the commentators just hoop, holler, rave. It's only one basket.
Right, right. Yeah, you're right, though, Oscar. His legacy was tainted by being a general manager for so many years that didn't do that well with the Clippers. I sat down with him years ago, and he told me something that his goal when he came into the NBA was to average 20 rebounds a game. And I was like, what? You're 6'5". What are you talking about? And he said, well, look it up. He says, I almost averaged 20 rebounds my first 2 years in the league. And I didn't know that. And I looked it up, and then he injured his knee.
Yes.
And then he was only able to average 13 or 15 rebounds a game.
That's correct. And look at the top guys today in basketball. If they can get 13, maybe 14. They don't get 14. I'm going to say 13. They said they're number top five all time greatest. They're the best things in sliced bread. You know what gets me on television? Everybody's the greatest.
Right. Yeah. You know,
this is why you have the championship basketball thing to see who's the greatest. But everybody's the greatest. They pick an MVP too soon in basketball during the regular season.
Yeah, they're talking about it 15 games into the season. Who's leading candidate for MVP?
Well, I think sometimes, they don't like the same guy to get the award all the time. I'll tell you that for a fact. So LeBron can stand a chance of getting it this year.
Right. Yeah, I know. That's why supposedly they gave it to Karl Malone instead of Jordan that 1 year. They said Michael had had enough. Hey, let me go backwards with you, Oscar, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Christmas Addicts. Your high school team was the first black team to win a state championship nationwide. Nationwide.
That's correct.
What was it like in those days for you playing in that atmosphere, that environment?
Well, I grew up in Indianapolis, from the west side of town, in the ghetto. I had an older brother, Bainer Robertson, who played. And so I was able to watch him a little bit and watch some of the other players on the team play. And, you know, we were all black, and we played almost basketball, baseball, or some kind of sport every day. Then my brother hit a shot and got him into the finals in 1951. And they got beat by a team called Evansville something, Evansville Whites, I believe. And from that point on, you know, it just seemed to be able to put some gas into everybody, all the guys around there, to be able to get back there and try to win that championship. But you know, we didn't have any goals in mind, to be honest. I must say, in those days, we just wanted to play. We had no contact with whites whatsoever. Although I did, most of my white friends were guys I played against. I got to know those guys, became real good friends with a lot of the guys. But other than that, you know, we're just an all-black team on the court, working together. We all knew each other. We played in the parks together all over the city, and that's how we came together.
And what was the reaction from the state, from the city, to you guys winning it?
Well, there was a couple of reactions, really. I think that doing the finals, we played against Gary Roosevelt, which was an all-black team in itself. And that's a story, but anyway, they had the cheerleaders from all the schools, all the schools, to join Christmas Addicts cheerleaders and root for us. Instead of calling us Christmas Addicts, they call us Indianapolis Addicts. So that's and Peter, it just moved things forward as far as race relations like crazy in Indianapolis. There was a coach named Charlie Moss who went to Arsenal Technical High School, which was about 5,000 students, if you can believe that. He was so enraged about us winning the state championship that he said he's tired of these black kids going over to Christmas Addicts all the time. So I think they passed a rule that if you lived in this section of town, you had to go to that school.
Right. I read somewhere that when you had a parade or something when you won it, but you were afraid. You were afraid to bring the parade through town. Tell me about that.
Well, we weren't afraid to go through town. You know, and the custom is that when you won a championship, they would take you on fire trucks from the Butler Fieldhouse, which is where we played, down to town, and they let you out in the middle of the town, which is called the circle. Therefore, they let you out where you would party and hoopla and do all the things that all the other champions would do. Until you got tired and went home. But with Christmas Addicts, you know, they felt that we would tear the city up, and maybe the city didn't want any black kids downtown on the circle. And so therefore they took us on the fire truck, stopped us momentarily to let the mayor speak to us about something, which I don't know what it was now. Then back out to a place called Northwestern Park, which was all black. And we had a big bonfire. From that point on, that's what happened.
Yeah, so things haven't changed all that much, have they?
They did it the next year too, Peter. And fortunately, I had little experience with that, so I didn't even go to the parade. I didn't ride downtown on the fire trucks at all. I went home.
Right. Oscar, let me again. Let me go somewhere else with you.
Yes.
In 1970. The NBA and the ABA had an agreement to merge, and you filed an antitrust lawsuit against the NBA, I suppose. What made you do that? And tell me that first. What was that? Larry Fleischer, was he the guy that was behind that? He was the executive director of the union. I don't even. Yeah, of the union.
Yeah. Yes, he was. Peter, what we did in those days when that happened, we felt it was collusion with the owners to try to stifle competition. But more than that, we talked to the other associations with football, baseball, and whatever, to get a feel of what was really going on. And we just felt that this was not the right thing to do, that the NBA had coerced or talked this ABA into coming over. But what they were going to do, Peter, they didn't bring all the teams over. They brought a few over, and some of the teams just went kaput, I should say, out of the way.
Right. But looking back, I mean, I understand the competition, and you know, there was going to be more money for the players on both sides if there wasn't a merger. But looking back, Oscar, you know, the way the players, today there are like 108 ABA players eligible for a pension these days, you know, that are alive today. You know, so the merger or the consolidation was delayed 6 years. I mean, to me, it just robbed so many players of recognition, and then it robbed them of a pension. You think about that at all?
No. Let me correct you a little bit.
All right.
Did the ABA have a pension? No. Why would the NBA have a pension for players who played in the ABA?
Why would they? Well, they don't have to, that's for sure. But if they came into the NBA, they would have had a pension.
If they came into the NBA, then they would have a pension.
Yes.
That is correct. When they came to the NBA, they had a pension at that point.
Yes.
And then today, they still have that pension. As a matter of fact, they're also a member of the Retired Players Association. And the Retired Players Association got some former Harlem Globetrotters, and also they got the women. I think they got the women included in it as well. I might stand corrected on that, but you can check that to be sure.
But the ABA players still don't have a pension. I mean, it's coming. I believe it's coming very soon that the NBA is going to take care of the ones who are left. But I'm just saying those 6 years.
Okay, let me say this, though, Peter. I understand that you know, in order to qualify for the NBA pension, you have to play 4 years.
Three, I believe.
Was it three?
Well, yeah, they might
have changed. Okay, so. If they didn't play the 3 years, then once they play 3 years in the NBA, do they go back and get the years they played in the ABA?
Yeah, you could. Yes, it would count 3 years in the ABA. Now, I'm not saying that. There are 108 players who were eligible 3 years or more in the ABA. Yeah, that they would.
Well, I understand. I think this is the problem. This is probably why the ABA owners wanted to come over. They didn't want to get involved in the costs and everything. Set all those things up. Because they knew it was a matter of competition with television and memorabilia and everything else. I don't know why. I mean, but no, I'm sure we talked about this. I don't recall the major conversation as far as giving players that played in the ABA pension rights before they ever got in the NBA. No, I don't think we ever agreed to do that.
Yeah. Who is besides Curry? Who is a favorite guy that you love to watch today? You have one? Few?
Oh yeah, I like several guys.
Who do you like?
I like LeBron. I definitely like Westbrook. I like to see Harden play. I like the Greek at Milwaukee. You know, there are a lot of outstanding players.
How about the Joker?
Well, Joker—he's a unique individual. He plays with his head as well. He's very, very well. He learned a lot playing overseas, I must tell you. And for a guy that can't jump very well, he gets it done. He stands on the floor, just shoots hook shots over the top of you. He's got a great outside shot. He makes it fake. Takes him maybe 10 seconds to go 15 feet. So.
He's an old school center.
But if you think about that, look at all of the foreign players who played who are real legitimate pivot men, Peter. They're all good players.
Right. Yeah, no, they come over here with much better fundamentals and better teamwork possibly. I'm not taking anything away from these guys, but I do love watching the Europeans play. I do not like the Euro step, Oscar. I think that
Well, first of all, you're old enough to watch Cy Green play, didn't you?
Oh, of course I saw Cy Green. Duquesne? Sure.
Yeah, that's what he did. He would step around you.
Really? He had that move?
But they didn't call it the Euro step then. And I can't tell you how many times I stepped around players going to the basket. But now all of a sudden, some guy who never played basketball, I'm telling you right now, he never played basketball. So, the Euro step, isn't that great? And years ago, we always called that traveling. You know, this is true. Years ago, when you did that, referees would call you call traveling on you.
That's my point. You know, I remember playing this kid in the playground once. You know, and we were just going at it for a long, long time and point game. And he took about four steps. You know, did all this stuff. I said, man, you can't do that. And he goes, what are you talking about? Earl Monroe does it.
Well, Earl used to spin with the ball and cuff it and whatnot. So. You know, but you know, here again, great basketball player. I must tell you, he didn't look the part. He didn't look like he could play very well. But man, was he great!
He is an unbelievable player. I hope to have him on the podcast one of these days. This guy has gone through like 35 major surgeries since he retired. I mean, it's an amazing thing.
If he's gone through that many, he should get several medals for that. I'm telling you,
yeah,
surgeries are not very easy.
Oscar, let me bring you back one more time to a game at Cutcher's. See if you remember it. I was the only writer who was allowed to play in the old timers game when it
was. Oh.
You remember?
Good for you.
No, do you remember it?
Yeah, I remember Cutcher's very well.
No. Do you remember me playing in the game?
No, I do not. I'm sorry.
All right, let me revive your memory here. So it was me, you, and Pistol on one team, and you guys were in the backcourt, and Dolph Shays was the coach. And about midway into the first quarter, Dolph Shays sends me in for you.
Did I come out?
No. And you said, there ain't no freaking way that I am coming out and being replaced by a sports writer.
Oh, come on.
You were serious? No. And Satch Sanders had to go out on the court and put his arm around you and take you off the court for me to get into the game. You remember it now?
Did I have my uniform on when I came up there? I may have been in the army then.
You had your uniform on. It was 1987. Pistol won the MVP. And then six months later, he died of a heart attack.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Wow. Well, I hope you forgive me.
Of course I forgive you. I understood perfectly. I thought it was hilarious. I said, this guy's competitive spirit is unbelievable. You know? No, I loved it, Oscar.
But you know, I tell you what, Peter, those were great games in those days. Because if Wilt came, Russell came, except I don't know if Kareem came.
Kareem came in the beginning. Yep.
I don't remember Kareem coming at all when I played.
I have a picture. Oh, yeah. I have a picture of you with Wilt, Kareem, and Stokes. And I think Campanella, too. I think Campanella was in the photo.
And they were in wheelchairs.
Yes. And they were in wheelchairs.
Okay. Yep. All right. Okay. I know. And it was a real classic game. And this was a game people look forward to seeing, man.
Yeah.
And Cutcher's with all those stars playing out there, and the Cutcher's, they loved it. It was great for them to do that. You know, they should get a medal for hosting those games like that.
Well,
for the people.
You know, I'm glad you brought it up, because one of my many pet peeves is that Helen Cutcher and Milt Cutcher have not been inducted into the Hall of Fame as contributors.
Oh.
They were taking care of indigent players after Stokes even passed.
Yes, they did.
They just ignore them. It's ludicrous.
Well, I tell you this, you know, I'm not that close to the Hall of Fame anymore. I think maybe Wayne is still on the board. I'm not sure. It's just something that is Bob. That a lot of people who, like the Cutchers, who did so much to us to help basketball in their day, should be recognized. And it's unbelievable that they aren't. So. I'm sorry to hear that. You know, I think you should keep pushing and talk to someone who's involved with that to try to get them in there.
Well, I'd push, but They do the Eurostep around me.
They still got that Eurostep going. Okay.
I'm gonna bring back Frank because we're gonna say goodbye to you, Oscar.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it, man.
Frank, say, got a few words for Oscar?
This is my thought. First of all, Oscar, it's a pleasure. Peter, not so much. What do you say, in lieu of the lovely parting gifts, we organize another game. This time, you come in for him.
Well,
I don't think you know, like that idea.
I'll tell you a story about coming in. I was in an all-star softball game here in Cincinnati, and I'm playing center field, and I ran down two balls, and next thing I know, the next inning, I'm in the outfield. I see this one guy who was he was about 6 foot, weighed about 275 pounds, running out the center field. He said, "Oscar, I'm in for you." I said, "The hell you are! Get out of here."
There you go. Oscar, you're replaceable. Oscar, I would like to have a nickel for every time I read the word incomparable before your name.
Well, you know, I enjoyed the game, and I tell you, even though I was put into a situation in Cincinnati where there was a lot of pressure on me to perform, and I did. I'm glad they did it because it made me a better basketball player.
As we see, as noted, as the statistics prove. Oscar, a thrill for me as usual to talk to you. I really appreciate you taking the time. God bless.
Peter, anytime. You guys take care.
God bless.
Appreciate it, sir.
Thank you for listening to Hoop du Jour with moi, Peter Vesey, and column castigator Frank Drucker. You can listen to all Hoop du Jour interviews by searching Legends Studios wherever you get your podcasts.